Hello, and welcome to the Government Satellite Report Radio, where we discuss innovative ways the federal government and United States military are utilizing satellites today. My name is Ryan Traden. I'm the executive editor of the Government Satellite Report online publication, and today we're going to be revisiting a government satellite program that we've actually discussed once before on our program, the Federal Aviation Administration's Wide Area Augmentation System, or WAAS for short. If you're unfamiliar with WAAS and maybe missed our last podcast on the system, don't worry, we'll forgive you. It's a terrestrial and satellite network that augments GPS and ensures greater precision in the routing and piloting of aircraft. So needless to say, if you've ever flown on an airplane, regardless of whether you've heard of WAAS or not, you're probably very happy that it exists. WAAS payloads have historically been launched into orbit as hosted payloads aboard commercial satellites, and that actually didn't change with the most recently launched WAAS payload, which was sent into orbit aboard SES-15, a hybrid satellite operated by commercial satellite provider SES. The last time we discussed WAAS, we focused on its uses and why the FAA elected to utilize hosted payloads for the system. But today, we're going to be joined by representatives from the company that actually made the most recent WAAS payload a reality. And those companies are Raytheon and SESGS. And they're here to discuss the launch itself, the SES-15 satellite, and the future of the WAAS program moving forward. They are Brian Benedict. He is the Senior Director of Innovation and Satellite Programs at SESGS, and Dana Hargrave, who is the Senior Program Manager for WAAS at Raytheon. Brian and Dana, thanks so much for appearing on today's show.
Hey, Ryan. It's a real pleasure to be speaking with you again after our very successful launch last month.
And yes, Ryan, thanks very much for this opportunity.
Hey, Brian, I know you've been on the show before, so thank you so much for coming back. I guess I didn't scare you away last time. And Dana, thanks for coming on for the first time, and hopefully we'll have you back in the future as well. So I'm going to ask you guys a couple of questions, and I'm going to direct the first one to Dana. So, Dana, tell us a little bit about Raytheon's history and its role with the WAAS program.
Okay, Raytheon goes back to the earliest days of the WAAS program. We are the original developer of WAAS for the FAA. But moreover, the Raytheon company is a leader in precision space-based navigation or satellite augmentation products. And our air traffic management systems are really operating around the world in more than 60 countries. So we've been partnering with the FAA for over two decades, not just supporting and enhancing the system, but with technical advice, working with them very closely. In 2012, we had the opportunity to participate in the replacement of the current satellite systems, which we did not do initially. So that part of it was done by other companies. And there's three satellites in the constellation. So we started with the first two of those satellites, which we call GEO-5 and GEO-6. So that's one and two of three that will eventually need to be replaced. So in this March of this year, we completed our ground integration and testing of the first one of those, which was GEO-5, and that was followed by GEO-6 by about a year. And so last month, in May, we had a successful launch, as we'll be talking about, of the SES-15 satellite, and that began the flight phase. That culminated along a couple of years of development leading up to that. Eventually will culminate when it's available on orbit in a ground system integration and then verification early next year.
Now, that's excellent. So, Brian, my next question is for you. What role did SESGS have in the development and the launch of the payload and SES-15? Yeah, and what responsibility and role does the company still play in operating the spacecraft and the payload today?
Well, Ryan, Raytheon subcontracted with SES Government Solutions to provide both the space segment that's on the satellite and the ground segment for the WAAS GEO-6 program. So we worked with our parent company, SES, the international company, to host the WAAS payload on board the SES-15 satellite being built at Boeing, which they were setting up for their commercial communications business. And so we were working with them the entire way through the design, the build, the test, and the launch of the satellite. And along with the satellite, as I mentioned, we have a couple of ground stations which we use to uplink signals to the WASP payload, and we need to provide to Raytheon, our customer, access to the WASP payload on board that satellite, as well as use of these two teleports for the entire life of this program.
Excellent. So we heard Dana talk a little bit about the launch of this thing. Let's get a little bit more into the specifics. Brian, can you tell us a little bit about the SES-15 launch? Where was it conducted, and when did it happen?
Sure. Well, the South American jungle clouds parted just before our launch, and we had an outstanding view of the ascent. The WASP payload was hosted on the SES-15 satellite, as we said, and it was launched on a Soyuz rocket out of French Guiana in a city called Kourou on May 18th of last month.
Excellent. Dana, I guess the big question, did everything go as planned with that launch? Is everything operational? Is everything working as intended?
Yes, Ryan. So you may be aware that there was a general strike in French Guiana, and we'd actually planned to launch in the first week in April. And because of that strike, which pretty much shut down everything, including the Ariane Space Center, we were delayed. But we were ready to go in April, and so was the Boeing team and the SES teams. But we ended up launching on the 18th of May, and once we got back there, I don't know how it could have gone any better. It was the boost to the geotransfer orbit was exactly on time. It was textbook perfect, and it was great. So, and we did get a good look at the flyout when it finally did happen. Now, because the Boeing 702, the satellite we use, is a 702SP or small platform satellite. And it is one of the first – well, it is the first satellite to achieve that's all electric. In other words, it doesn't carry chemical-type thrusters to go to geo. But because it is electric propulsion, ion thrust, it's very low impulse, and it takes about 6 months to attain geostationary orbit. So right now we're just waiting out that six-month time to get to geo, and then we'll at that point we will turn on the payload and get a look at it. But – one thing that's very important is the extensive ground testing that we do at the Boeing factory, and we build up from the components into the payload into the overall vehicle, all of the environmental testing and functional testing that's done before it ships. So we leave the satellite and the payload leave the factory with a very high confidence that they're ready to fly and they're going to be operational when they get where they belong. And so we're highly confident that that payload will work just fine once it's turned on.
Dana, you said something really interesting. I bet all of our listeners, it probably caught their attention as well. You mentioned that there was a strike that pushed this launch back by a month. Is that something that happens frequently in French Guiana? And if so, why launch out of there? I just have to know.
I'm going to let my supplier answer that question, Brian.
Strikes within the French community are frequent, but there are a number of reasons that the industry in French Guiana was striking. It's been resolved. As far as we know, Arianespace got their schedule right back, and they're moving forward. It's not a huge concern for launch having strikes. It does happen from time to time, and it becomes high visibility simply because launches are very high visibility themselves.
That makes sense. So, Brian, let's stick with you for a second. So I understand there was, and Dana referenced one of these already, I believe, but I referenced there's a handful of firsts with both this spacecraft and the launch. So can you tell us a little bit about what made this spacecraft and the launch unique and what some of those firsts were?
Sure, Ryan. There are a couple of big firsts here. One that Dana already mentioned, that has to do with the fact that SES-15 is the first all-electric satellite built for and operated by SES. And that means that it has a very low thrust, but it's extremely efficient. So we get to orbit much more efficiently, but it takes longer. But that also means that we can get onto a less expensive rocket, and once we get to orbit, we can operate the satellite for quite a long time. The other thing of interest is that this is the first time that SES has hosted a WASP payload for use by the FAA. And we're very excited about that.
Excellent. So, Dana, you mentioned that it's probably going to be a while till the satellite actually reaches geo orbit and is functioning. So how are Raytheon and SES working together to ensure that the payload accomplishes its mission you know, when it does get into orbit? And additionally, what do you need to do to convince the FAA that the WASP payload is ready for, quote-unquote, prime time?
Okay, Ryan, yeah, you're absolutely right. There's a number of things along this road, and it literally takes several years to get where we're going. So that milestone of getting the launch off and getting established in geostationary Earth orbit is key, but it will be about two more years before our payload, our GEO-6 payload, becomes fully operational in the national airspace, and that means that that commercial users will be able to have access to that signal and navigate with it. So once the satellite SES-15 reaches its geostation, which will be late this year, right now we're forecasting November, SES and Raytheon will work together to complete what we call in-orbit testing, or IOT. And that test basically turns on the payload, as we mentioned before, and confirms that everything is working as advertised. In other words, that there haven't been any significant deviations from the data that we collected on the ground, and everything is working. And, you know, there's always a risk of some damage during launch or orbit raising. But as I said, this mission, the launch and all that went so well, we have every reason to think that it's just going to be fine when we get where we're going. The other piece of this is that SES has control centers to control and communicate and control the satellite, and we want to verify that those are operating. So we have another verification that involves that, and we're in the planning stages for that at this time. So after we get the satellite checked out and ready to operate and begin to integrate with the ground systems, we're going to spend the next 4 or 5 months doing that. So those two ground sites that Brian mentioned now they've got to play together, communicate, and make sure that they meet all of our and FAA requirements. So at the end of that time, then we do a full-on final exam, extensive verification test to make sure we really are ready for that prime time you mentioned. And then after that happens, then the FAA and Raytheon will work together to integrate that new geosatellite system into the overall WASP system, and we'll verify the conformance at that level. We'll complete what we call cutover, which is retiring the old satellite that it's replacing, and install the new one. And then we'll be ready to go operational. We forecast right now to be mid 2019. And then once that happens, then we go into a 10-year service lease. So we have at least 10 years of operations, and then even the potential for, if the FAA desires, to extend beyond that if the satellite's healthy.
Well, we're going to have you both on in 2019 to talk about this again, so we can go over
right.
Everything went as planned and we're operational. Hopefully I still have a podcast by 2019. All right, so I have one question I'd like to open up to the two of you. You know, obviously we don't see a lot of hosted payloads being done across the federal government. We see the FAA is kind of a pioneer in that, but we see NASA has done some. But for the most part, I think I can safely say that the government's been a little reticent to embrace hosted payload programs. So what would you both say that the government can learn from the WASP program, this most recent launch, and the continued success of hosted payload programs across the industry?
You know, Ryan, if the WASP program teaches us anything, it's that commercial industry can be trusted to provide dependable operational capability to the United States government. You know, as Dana mentioned, the contract for this payload is in excess of a decade, and the U.S. government ought to be able to clone that sort of a model to secure long-term and lower-cost capability in other areas, such as communications or hosting of imaging payloads.
Yeah, from my point of view, we at Raytheon and OSES, the same, we view WASP to be all about aviation safety. It's about making flight predictable, safe, and avoiding air mishaps because of the precision navigation capability that it offers. So when we partner with the commercial satellite industry and companies like SES in developing and then leasing, basically hitchhiking on their very, very expensive satellites, to put that WASP signal out in space, it makes it affordable. And were it not for that ability, which that has been proven in the WASP program, we might not have WASP. So if you consider the cost of what it would cost the FAA and the taxpayer to put up a dedicated satellite with a WASS capability on it, could be done, but it would cost hundreds of million dollars more than the current program costs. And at that point, I don't know that we'd have a WASS. So this is a huge enabler, a huge win-win for the FAA. Us as taxpayers, I think it's good for the satellite industry. And I think there's many, many broader opportunities for hosted payloads across all technology. But I think this is proof of the concept. But the biggest beneficiaries, are the aviation users and the passengers that fly with them.
I concur. As a taxpayer and as someone who flies, I greatly appreciate this program and its use of hosted payloads. And yeah, I'm hoping the federal government, the rest of the government, I should say, is keeping their eyes on the best practices and the lessons learned that come out of WASS. Unfortunately, I know we could probably talk about WASS for days, but we're out of time for today's show, so I'm going to have to cut this riveting hosted payload discussion short. However, I do want to thank you both for taking the time to be on the program and sharing some more info about WASS and the recent SES 15 launch with our listeners, and hopefully I'll have you both back on in 2019, and we'll talk about how this all went down.
Ryan, and thank you for inviting us on your program today.
Yes, Ryan, thanks so much for the opportunity.
Hey, the pleasure has been all mine. To our listeners, I'd want to thank you guys as well for joining us for this discussion. If you like what you heard, I'd encourage you to check out the Government Satellite Report publication for even more exciting satellite-focused content that can be found online at www.govsatreport.com. I'd also encourage you to check back frequently for new podcasts, much like this one.